protein and low in fat. And while it's true that poultry's omega-6 and 3 ratios are out of whack, about 10 to 1, whereas beef is about 2 to 1, we can easily handle any fatty acid imbalances by supplementing with fish or krill oil or eating fatty fish like salmon, tuna, trout, herring, sardines, or mackerel. A pound of chicken breast has about 100 grams of protein and will cost you about $3.50. Almonds. Almonds are by far my favorite type of nut. They're delicious and nutritious, with a handful, about 15, weighing in at 9 grams of healthy fat, 4 grams of protein, and just under 4 grams of carbs. Like eggs, they have also been associated with various health benefits, such as a reduced risk of diabetes and lower body weight. Almonds cost about 50 cents per ounce, 25 to 30 nuts, making them easy to fit into any budget. They're great by themselves and go well in cold cereals like granola or muesli and hot cereals like oatmeal. However, my favorite way to eat them is to buy freshly ground almond butter. It's delicious by itself, but it shines when you combine it with fruits like bananas or apples. Low-fat cottage cheese. You can buy a half-cup serving of low-fat cottage cheese for less than a dollar, and you get 14 grams of protein and only 1 gram of fat. I think it tastes great with just a dash of salt and pepper, but I also like it with fruit, such as pineapple or berries. Protein powder. Many people are surprised to learn that protein powder can be cost-efficient. For instance, my naturally sweetened 100% whey isolate protein, which you can learn more about at the end of the book, costs about $18 per pound. That's about 400 grams of the highest quality whey protein for 18 bucks. Avocado. Avocados are a great source of dietary fat, and of monounsaturated fat in particular. One avocado contains about 15 grams, which has been associated with better cholesterol levels, a reduced risk of cardiovascular disease, and improved brain function. On top of that, avocados are full of cancer-fighting phytochemicals. You can do more with them than just make guacamole as well. They go great with eggs, soups, and salsas. Although the prices fluctuate due to seasonal highs and lows in both demand and production, they usually range between $1 to $2 per fruit. Cheap sources of healthy carbs. The most popular forms of carbohydrate here in the United States are processed junk foods, which, as you know, can pose serious health risks if consumed too regularly for too long. On the other hand, the regular intake of nutritious carbohydrates has been associated with a reduced risk of chronic disease. Here are my favorite sources of cheap, healthy carbs. Oats. 1 cup of dry steel cut oats packs just over 50 grams of carbs, 10 grams of protein, and 6 grams of fat. You can buy it in bulk for about a dollar per pound, and it's a great source of medium GI carbohydrate and dietary fiber. Research has also demonstrated that oats can reduce levels of LDL, bad cholesterol. Oatmeal in a bowl is a staple in many bodybuilders' diets, but you can even substitute blended oats for flour when baking, or use them as breadcrumbs or breading for spicing up chicken dishes. Black beans. Black beans are an awesome source of carbohydrates as well as protein, potassium, calcium, folic acid, and fiber. 1 cup of these beans contains about 40 grams of carbs, 15 grams of protein, and 1 gram of fat, and you can buy them for about a dollar per can, or in bulk, dry, for even less. Boil them up, and they make a great side to any protein dish, but they're also perfect for making soups and dips. Brown rice. Like oatmeal, brown rice is a go-to food for the fitness-minded, and for good reason. You can pick it up dirt cheap, around $2 per pound, and 1 cup provides close to 45 grams of carbs, 5 grams of protein, and 2 grams of fat. Brown rice has nearly 4 times the fiber as white rice, as well as more vitamins, minerals, and other beneficial micronutrients. Quinoa. It might be hard to pronounce, quinoa, but it's easy to prepare, extremely tasty, cheap, about $4 per box, and full of healthy protein and carbs. 1 cup of dry kernels has 110 grams of carbs, 24 grams of protein, and 10 grams of fat, and it can be prepared in the same ways as brown rice. Fruit. You can't go wrong with fruit. My favorite choices are grapes, apples, bananas, and oranges, which are full of a variety of antioxidants, vitamins, minerals, and fibers, and which range between 60 cents and $1.50 per pound. If you're worried that the fructose in fruit might be bad for your health, though, you can rest easy. You'd have to eat an absolute ridiculous amount of fruit every day to ever have a problem. According to a meta-analysis of clinical trials evaluating fructose intake, 25 to 40 grams of fructose per day has no negative impact on our health. That's 3 to 6 bananas, 6 to 10 cups of strawberries, 10 to 15 cherries, or 2 to 3 apples per day. Or, as the old advice goes, a few servings of fruit every day. Problems with fructose intake are only seen among those who regularly eat large amounts of refined sugars, like HFCS or sucrose. For instance, a 20-ounce bottle of soda sweetened with HFCS contains about 35 grams of fructose. 1 gram of sucrose is about half glucose, half fructose. So if you eat a dessert with 50 grams of sugar, you're getting about 25 grams of fructose. Even agave nectar, which is touted as healthy by many due to its low glycemic properties, can be as high as 90% fructose. Other less processed forms can be as low as 55%. The bottom line is that you can avoid all the health complications associated with fructose intake by limiting your intake of foods with added sugars, like agave, sucrose, honey, maple syrup, raw sugar, molasses, brown sugar, HFCS, turbinado sugar, and on and on. Sweet potato. Sweet potatoes can hit the spot when you want something sweet and nutritious. They're extremely tasty when prepared well. Salt, cinnamon, pumpkin spice, and a little bit of butter is my jam. And they're in the middle of the glycemic index and full of vitamin A and other micronutrients. 1 cup of mashed sweet potato provides you with about 60 grams of carbs, 4 grams of protein, and less than 1 gram of fat. And at a paltry cost of about $1 per pound, you can't afford to not include sweet potato in your meal plans. The bottom line. So there you have it. It is possible to eat healthfully without maxing out your credit cards. In fact, you may even save money if you use a few other tricks like buying frozen veggies, buying in bulk, paying attention to sales and what's in and out of season, and preparing your food in batches so you can use everything you buy. And let's not forget that the ultimate value of eating well, longevity, vitality, and disease-free living, is hard to put a price tag on. Now, I know this section of the book has given you a lot to process, but I have good news. You've learned just about everything you'll ever need to know about dieting. You'll never struggle with building muscle or losing fat again if you just follow the principles and advice I've shared. Feel free to re-listen to this section of the book to let everything sink in. Let's now move on to the subject of training and learn how to get the most out of our time in the gym every day. Section 4. Training. Chapter 16. The Bigger, Leaner, Stronger Training Philosophy. Far too many bodybuilders spend too much time exercising the smaller muscle groups such as the biceps at the expense of the larger muscle groups such as the thighs, and then they wonder why it is that they never make gains in overall size and strength. Rory Reg Park. Too many of the training programs touted in the magazines and infomercials are essentially the same. Lots of machines, lots of isolation exercises, lots of reps with little weight, and lots of time in the gym. These programs are better than nothing, I suppose, but that's about the only compliment I can pay them. There are just vastly superior ways to spend your time and energy if your goal is to build a physique, not just move your body. Ironically, machines became a staple of gyms not because they're particularly effective or even safe, but because they're inviting. They don't look nearly as intimidating as dumbbells, bars, and plates. Well, while a small number of machines are worth using, such as the leg press machine or cable setup, the vast majority are inferior to dumbbell and barbell exercises in terms of producing bigger, stronger muscles. This includes the Smith machine, which has been proven to be less effective for squatting and bench pressing than the free weight barbell squat and bench press. Therefore, the Bigger, Leaner, Stronger program will focus on free weights and not on machines. We've already talked about the inferiority of isolation exercises, but you're probably wondering why they're so popular among bodybuilders, whose lives revolve around sculpting every last muscle fiber in their bodies for competitive shows. Many of those guys are freakishly huge, and if that's how they train, there must be something to it, right? I mean, hell, if we could just get one-third as big as them, we'd be happy. Well, there's more to the story. Here's what it boils down to. Every professional bodybuilder going anywhere in the sport is on drugs. A lot of drugs. Like $50,000 to $100,000 worth of drugs per year. Yes, every single one, regardless of what they say. And while there are different schools of thought as to the optimal style of training when you're on drugs, many chemically enhanced lifters have success just sitting in the gym for hours every day doing set after set after set with relatively light weights. You see, thanks to the drugs they're on, their bodies are able to synthesize muscle proteins at alarmingly high rates, and this alone allows them to do a lot of things with their training and diets that just wouldn't work if they were natural. The big problem with focusing on isolation exercises is that the average guy needs to build a strong overall foundation of strength and muscle, not gain an extra half inch on his rear delts or extend his lats an inch lower down his torso. There's only one way to build that base naturally. You have to do a lot of heavy compound weightlifting. And even then, it takes a couple of years to gain the 25 to 35 pounds of muscle that takes a guy from normal to ripped. That's why the Bigger Leaner Stronger program is built around heavy, lower rep weightlifting and compound exercises like the squat, deadlift, military press, bench press, and many others. Emphasizing heavy weightlifting is the only way to continue to progressively overload your muscles, and compound exercises like those listed earlier give you the most bang for your buck, the most total body strengthening and conditioning for the time and effort spent. The Bigger Leaner Stronger training program follows a formula that looks like this. 1 to 2, 4 to 6, 9 to 12, 3 to 4, 60 to 65, 5 to 7, 8 to 10. No, that isn't a secret code that you have to break. Let's go through this formula one piece at a time. 1 to 2. Train 1 to 2 muscle groups per day. To achieve maximum overload and muscle stimulation, you will train 1 or 2 muscle groups per workout per day. While upper, lower, and full body splits can work if programmed correctly, they come with several drawbacks. The first is the fact that training multiple major muscle groups in one workout is very hard when you're focusing on heavy compound weightlifting, when you do 6 sets of heavy chest pressing and then try to move on to heavy shoulder pressing, you simply won't lift as much as you would if you saved your shoulder work for another day. By training only 1 or 2 muscle groups per day, you'll be able to give your workouts 100% focus and intensity and train hard without struggling through the systemic and muscular fatigue that comes with trying to do too much in a workout. Training several major muscle groups in one workout also takes a lot of time. I used to do long 1.5 to 2 hour workouts and, quite frankly, didn't look forward to many of them. I'm now in and out in no more than an hour and find that much more enjoyable, which helps me stick with the program for the long haul. 4 to 6. Do sets of 4 to 6 reps for nearly all exercises. You knew I was going to have you lifting a lot of heavy weight, and here's what it comes down to. Working in the 4 to 6 rep range for nearly all exercises. We'll go over the exceptions soon. This means that you're going to be using weights that allow for at least 4 reps, but no more than 6 reps. If you can't get 4 reps, it's too heavy. If you can get 6 or more, it's too light. Generally speaking, this is about 85% of your 1RM for each exercise. You won't be doing burnout sets, supersets, drop sets, or anything else but controlled heavy sets. Leave the lightweight muscle confusion routines to the amateurs, and it will only be a matter of time before they come to you, baffled as to how you're gaining so much by doing so little. The emphasis of heavy compound weightlifting is a vitally important aspect of the program and is the heart of the whole training approach. It's also one of the more controversial recommendations in the book, as the optimal rep range for muscle growth is still a subject of heated debate rather than scientific certainty. That said, I didn't choose this rep range willy-nilly. It's based on a considerable amount of both clinical and anecdotal evidence. And before we go on, I'd like to share some of that here so you have a better understanding as to why I don't recommend the more traditional hypertrophy rep range of 10 to 12 reps. A large review of weightlifting studies was published in 2007 by researchers from Göteborg University, and it contained 2 key findings for our purposes. One, training with weights between 70% and 85% of 1 RM produced maximum hypertrophy in subjects, although lower and higher loads also produced marked results. Two, a moderate training volume of 30 to 60 reps per workout produced maximum hypertrophy in subjects. As the load decreased, the optimal number of reps increased. That is, the lighter the weights you're using, the more reps you want to do to maximally stimulate muscle growth. The American College of Sports Medicine published a paper in 2002 that, based on the study of hundreds of subjects, concluded that training with weights that allowed no more than 5 to 6 reps is most effective for increasing strength, and that resting up to 3 minutes in between sets is optimal when training in this fashion. Researchers from Arizona State University reviewed 140 other weightlifting studies and concluded that training with weights that are 80% of your one rep max produces maximal strength gains. Yet another sign of the effectiveness of lifting heavy weights is found in a study published by scientists from Ohio University who had 32 untrained men lift weights for 8 weeks. They were split into 3 groups. One worked in the range of 3 to 5 reps, another in the range of 9 to 11 reps, and the last in the range of 20 to 28 reps. By the end of the 8-week period, the group working in the 3 to 5 rep range made significantly more gains in both strength and muscle than the other 2 groups. Now, if you're well-read in the fitness world, you've undoubtedly come across studies with findings contrary to those mentioned previously. For instance, there are at least 2 studies I know of commonly used to sell people on the belief that lifting light weights is as effective in building muscle as lifting heavy weights, so long as you train to failure. There are major problems with these findings, however, because they don't jibe with real-world observations. Namely, the people who have built impressive physiques using high-rep, burnout training almost always were chemically enhanced at some point along the way. And on the flip side, nearly every person you'll meet who has built a strong muscular body naturally will have done it by focusing on heavy weightlifting. They may now maintain their physique with higher rep training, but they didn't get there with it. I went through this with my own body. Nearly 8 years of grueling high rep training got me no more than 25 to 30 pounds of lean mass, with at least half of that coming in the first 3 years. Eventually, I sunk into a rut and made no real gains to speak of for several years. I was able to progress again by applying what I'm teaching you in this book, lifting heavy weights and regulating and balancing my food intake. Since making these changes, my strength has exploded and my physique has dramatically changed. I've increased my weights on every lift by 50 to 100% and went from about 197 pounds at 16% body fat to my current 187 pounds at 7%, which I maintain with ease. I've also had the opportunity to work directly with thousands of people, and the results are uniform from person to person regardless of age, genetics, or training history. Every day I email with guys who were stuck in the same rut I was and who are now making gains again by focusing on heavy lifting and proper dieting. So don't worry if people question your approach and tell you to lighten the load and increase the reps. There's no universally accepted answer just yet as to what is truly the absolute most effective way to train for both strength and hypertrophy, and there may never be one. The subject is just incredibly complicated with a staggering number of variables to consider and control for. But know this, every well-designed, well-executed study I've seen agrees that training with 70 to 85% of your 1 RM works. At this point, I can say with absolute certainty that there's just something special about emphasizing heavy compound weightlifting in your training. I'm in good company here as well. Many of the most respected people in this industry, such as Brad Schoenfeld, Mark Ripito, Lane Norton, Alan Aragon, Lyle McDonald, and Pavel Tsatsouline, also advocate the same style of training for maximal results in the gym. And the best part is that you don't have to take my word on all of this. If you just follow the workout routine laid out in this book and in the bonus report, you will make startling strength and size gains. 9 to 12. Do 9 to 12 heavy sets per workout. Regardless of which exercises you do, the workouts on this program will call for 9 to 12 heavy or working sets per workout, which are your muscle-building sets that you'll be doing after warming up. As you'll see, the workouts in the 5 and 4 day plans will always contain 9 working sets for the major muscle group being trained, but will also provide 3 additional optional sets that you can do if you're feeling up to it. If you're brand new to weightlifting and are pretty spent after 9 sets, don't feel like you have to do the final 3. If you're more experienced or just have plenty of energy at the end of 9 sets, feel free to do the 3 extras. Don't get overzealous and do more than this in each workout, though, even if you feel like you can keep going after 12 working sets. Doing more isn't going to help you build more muscle and can eventually lead to overtraining. If you're used to spending a couple of hours in a gym every day, pounding out set after set after set, this style of training is going to feel strange to you. In fact, at first you'll probably feel like you're being lazy or barely even working out. That's how I felt, at least. You're probably going to doubt that you can get bigger and stronger than ever by working out less than everyone else. But don't worry, it won't require any great leap of faith. Trust in the program and it will deliver. Suspend your disbelief for just a few weeks and the results will speak for themselves. Research and anecdotal evidence has shown me that 50 to 70 heavy reps performed with each major muscle group every 5 to 7 days is a sweet spot for getting the most out of natural weightlifting. 3 to 4. Rest 3 to 4 minutes in between sets. When you lift weights, a staggering number of physiological activities are taking place to enable you to perform the exercise. For a muscle to contract, it requires cellular energy, oxygen, certain chemical reactions, and many other molecular processes. And as you perform each rep, you deplete your muscle's capacity to contract forcefully. When you lift heavy weights, you push your muscles to their full contraction capacity. Sufficient recovery time in between sets is what allows you to repeat this process enough to achieve the optimum amount of muscle overload to stimulate and force new growth. Basically, the whole point of resting between sets is to prepare your muscles to lift maximum weight in the next set. This isn't just theory either. Clinical research has correlated intra-set rest times and gains in both strength and muscle size. For instance, one study conducted by researchers at the Federal University of Paraná in Brazil found that when subjects performed the bench press and squat with 2-minute rest intervals, they were able to perform significantly more repetitions per workout than when rest intervals were shortened to 15-second increments. 1 minute 45 seconds, 1 minute 30 seconds, 1 minute 15 seconds, and so forth. This is significant because, as you know, total workout volume is a major factor in achieving overload and stimulating muscle growth. Thus, it's not surprising that a study conducted by researchers at Kennesaw State University found that subjects gain more muscle when training to failure with 2.5-minute rest periods as opposed to 1-minute periods. Due to the amount of weight you're using in bigger, leaner, stronger workouts, you should rest for 3 to 4 minutes in between your working sets. That might sound excessive, but that timing wasn't chosen randomly. It's based on clinical research. For instance, an extensive review of weightlifting studies conducted by researchers at State University of Rio de Janeiro found the following. In terms of acute responses, a key finding was that when training with loads between 50% and 90% of one repetition maximum, 3 to 5 minutes rest between sets allowed for greater repetitions over multiple sets. Furthermore, in terms of chronic adaptations, resting 3 to 5 minutes between sets produced greater increases in absolute strength due to higher intensities and volumes of training. Similarly, higher levels of muscular power were demonstrated over multiple sets with 3 or 5 minutes versus 1 minute of rest between sets. These findings were echoed by another study conducted by scientists at Eastern Illinois University with resistance-trained men. The findings of the present study indicate that large squat strength gains can be achieved with a minimum of 2 minutes rest between sets, and little additional gains are derived from resting 4 minutes between sets. In another paper, the same research team analyzed bench press performance with the same subjects and found the following. When the training goal is maximal strength development, 3 minutes of rest should be taken between sets to avoid significant declines in repetitions. The ability to sustain repetitions while keeping the intensity constant may result in a higher training volume and consequently greater gains in muscular strength. Just like the shorter workouts will feel strange at first, the longer rest times are going to feel really weird. You're going to feel like you're sitting around more than you're working out. But again, let the results speak for themselves. You'll notice that you retain your strength much better set after set when you use proper rest periods, which is crucial for continuing to recruit maximal muscle fibers with each set. Some days you'll feel energized and ready to lift again after 3 minutes, but other days you'll feel a bit slower and will need the full 4 minutes. The test isn't whether you want to do the next set, by the way. It's whether your body's heart rate has come down since the last set and you feel like you have the energy to do another. 60 to 65. Train for 60 to 65 minutes. If your workouts are going much longer than an hour, something is wrong. You should be able to finish every bigger, leaner, stronger workout in 60 to 65 minutes. Long workouts are not only unnecessary, but are often counterproductive as well. As you know, despite their grueling nature, extremely high-volume workouts are just a recipe for stagnation. When workout intensity is high, as it is with this program, workout volume needs to be moderate or you'll wind up overtraining. This means shorter workouts. Time your rest periods and keep the chatting to a minimum, and you'll get through your workouts efficiently, which will help you stay focused on your workouts and give them 100%. 5 to 7. Train each muscle group 1 to 2 times every 5 to 7 days. The amount of time you give a muscle group to rest before training it again plays a vital role in the process of muscle growth. Quite a few training programs have you performing 2 to 3 full workouts for every major muscle group every week, often alternating between very heavy and lighter weights. Some of these programs are based on good scientific research, but they fall short in one area, recovery. Recovery, both muscular and nervous systemic, is what makes or breaks all of the work you put in to get you the body you want. If you don't allow your body to fully recover from a workout before you subject the same muscles to overload again, it doesn't matter how strictly you follow your diet or this training protocol. Eventually, you will struggle to make progress, and you will feel physically worse and worse over time. If you continue training with insufficient recovery for too long, you can lose strength and muscle as well as all motivation for working out. You can also wind up with depressive and chronic fatigue-like symptoms, lose your appetite and sex drive, sleep poorly, and experience other negative effects. One for one, natural weightlifters I've spoken with who have tried various 2 or 3 a week programs have run into these types of recovery problems, especially when they're dieting for weight loss, as a calorie deficit makes it even easier to become overtrained. Well, you're not going to run into any of these problems if you stick to the bigger, leaner, stronger training schedule, which carefully balances training frequency, volume, and intensity in recovery. As you'll see, each week on the program is going to involve hitting every major muscle group in the body with one primary, heavy, intense workout, with some additional lighter, but not light, upper body work to ensure it doesn't fall behind, and the option of additional lower body work if it's needed. 8 to 10. Dial it back every 8 to 10 weeks. Heavy weightlifting can feel pretty brutal at first. It takes quite a bit of physical effort and mental concentration. Your muscles will ache. Your joints and tendons will have to adapt. As if all that weren't enough, there's more. It puts the central nervous system under tremendous stress as well, which manifests in subtle ways. Although there are contradictory theories as to what is truly going on here physiologically, what we know for sure is repeated bouts of weightlifting cause a non-muscular fatigue to develop in the body. This, in turn, leads to reductions in speed, power, and the ability to perform technical movements or exercises. Some research indicates that this may be more of a sensation or emotion rather than a true physical issue, but the bottom line is that it will affect you, so you need to know how to deal with it. And the easiest way to refresh your entire body is to periodically reduce the intensity of your training or take a week off the weights altogether. Thus, between each of its 8-week phases, the Bigger Leaner Stronger program includes a choice between what is known as a deload week and several days, or even an entire week, off the weights. We'll talk about how exactly the deload week works soon, but it simply involves lower intensity training for a week. The choice between a deload week and taking a short break from the weights is up to you. I recommend that you start with deload weeks, but if you don't feel reinvigorated by the end of them and physically and mentally ready to hit the heavy weights again, then I recommend that you try no training whatsoever for at least 4 to 5 days before getting back to it. Many guys fear that they are going to shrink or come back weaker if they take a week or even a few days off the weights. But this simply isn't the case. Research has shown that even in the elderly, significant strength loss isn't seen until about 5 weeks of no exercise. In terms of how to eat on your deload week or week off the weights, if you're bulking, you can reduce your calories to a maintenance level, and if you're cutting, you don't have to change anything. How to progress on the program. As you know, the most important aspect of weightlifting is achieving progressive overload by continuing to add weight to your lifts over time. If you did everything else right, if you ate correctly, focused on heavy compound weightlifting, and trained with a proper frequency, but simply didn't add weight to the bar as you went along, you would quickly plateau. It's that important. And that's why the Bigger Leaner Stronger program has a simple method of progression. Once you hit 6 reps for one set, you add weight for your next set. The standard increase is a total of 10 pounds, 5 pounds added to either side of the barbell, or a 5-pound increase in each dumbbell. For instance, if you get 225 for 6 reps on your first set of incline bench press, you then add 10 pounds, 5 pounds to each side of the bar, rest, and work with 235 going forward. If, after moving up like this, you only get 2 to 3 reps, you can reduce the weight by 5 pounds, leaving it at 5 pounds heavier than the weight with which you got 6 reps. Or if your gym doesn't have 2.5-pound plates, simply drop back to the weight that you got 6 with and finish your remaining sets with that. Then, the next week, try to make the jump again, starting fresh with your first set, and you should get 4 or even 5 reps. In most cases, however, you'll simply get 6 reps, add 10 pounds, rest, and then get 4 reps on subsequent sets. Your primary goal with every workout should be beating the previous week's numbers, even if only by 1 rep. If you do that again the next week, you're ready to move up in weight. You should know, however, that some weeks just won't go like that. Sometimes you'll only be able to lift exactly what you did the week prior. Sometimes you'll even be a rep weaker. These things happen, and don't necessarily mean anything is wrong. Just keep working at it, and you should see a slow, steady increase in weight lifted over time. Where's my pump? If you're used to high rep pump training, you should know that lower rep heavy training is quite different. Don't be surprised if, for the first several weeks, your muscles feel less full than what you're used to. It's normal. You see, heavy lifting does give a nice pump, but it's not the "my muscles are about to explode" type that many guys obsess over and think is so important. Remember, however, that while a huge pump might be great for peacocking in the gym, it has little to do with long-term muscle growth. Overload is what we want. A pump is just a byproduct. So long as you keep hitting the weights hard, your muscles will grow, and as your muscles grow, you'll get more and more of a pump from heavy lifting. And better yet, you'll be one of the rare guys who can look great without any pump at all because you have a true foundation of solid lean mass, not small muscles that need to fill up with blood to even be noticeable. The proper rep tempo for maximum gains. Rep timing refers to the speed at which you lower and raise the weights, and there are quite a few opinions out there as to what is best. One of the more popular schools of thought is using very slow reps to maximize time under tension and thus muscle growth. Your muscles don't know weight, many bodybuilders say, almost waxing philosophic. They only know tension, and that's what stimulates growth. Well, like the many weird little tricks of the fitness space, you know the ones that are supposed to instantly increase your bench press or melt off belly fat. Time under tension is not important enough to warrant special attention, and is simply a byproduct of proper training that can, more or less, be ignored. You see, the more slowly you perform your reps with a given weight, the fewer reps you can perform with it. Depending on how slowly you went, you might get half the reps or even less as a normal rep tempo. As you reduce the number of reps you perform, you also reduce the total work performed by the muscle. And as you reduce the amount of work performed, you reduce the muscle and strength-building potential of the exercise. The question, then, is whether the trade-off of time under tension for total work is worth it. Does increasing time under tension make up for the reduction in work performed and result in more strength progression and muscle growth? The research says no. For example, a study conducted by scientists at the University of Sydney found that subjects following traditional fast training on the bench press gained more strength than slow training. A study conducted by researchers at the University of Connecticut found that very slow training resulted in lower levels of peak force and power when compared with a normal self-regulated tempo. A study conducted by scientists at the University of Wisconsin found that even in untrained individuals, a traditional training tempo resulted in greater strength in the squat and greater peak power in the counter-movement jump. A study conducted by researchers at the University of Oklahoma found that 4 weeks of traditional resistance training was more effective for increasing strength than super slow training. These findings aren't exactly surprising given the underlying mechanics of muscle growth and how reliant it is on building strength. If you want bigger muscles, you're going to have to get stronger. To quote researchers from Ithaca College who compared fast tempo bench pressing to slow tempo, one way repeated measures analysis of variance showed tempos with a fast eccentric phase, 1 second, and no bottom rest produced significantly greater, P less than 0.05 PO power output, and repetitions than tempos involving slower eccentric velocity, 4 seconds, or greater bottom rest, 4 seconds. This combination of greater repetitions and PO resulted in a greater volume of work. Varying inter-repetition rest, 1 or 4 seconds, did not significantly affect PO or repetitions. The result of this study support the use of fast eccentric speed and no bottom rest during acute performance testing to maximize PO and number of repetitions during a set of bench press. It's also worth noting that back when I didn't know what I was doing, I used to do a lot of slow sets to maximize time under tension, and my results were in line with the research. I found it no more effective than my regular training routines, which were pretty crappy in reality. So, the rep timing I recommend is either the 2-1-2 or 2-1-1 timing. This means the first part of the rep should take about 2 seconds, which is followed by a 1 second or shorter pause, which is followed by the final portion of the rep, which should take between 1 and 2 seconds to perform. For example, if we apply this to the bench press, it means we are to lower the bar to our chest in 2 seconds, pause for 1 second or less, and raise it in 1 or 2 seconds. Intensity and focus, your two secret weapons. If you trained before, you know what makes a great workout. You're full of energy, the weights feel light, you're completely focused on your lifts, and you're able to push yourself further than you expected. A big part of having this kind of workout as often as possible is consciously lifting with intensity and focus. And that doesn't mean loud grunting with death metal blaring in your headphones. While some of those types do train pretty intensely, none of the showmanship is necessary. Instead, I recommend that we take a page from the famous Bulgarian powerlifters' books and imitate their counterintuitive type of training for hitting one-rep lifts. They didn't stomp around like a madman or spend 15 minutes amping themselves up to screaming guitars and vocals. Instead, they just walked up to the bar and hit the lift as calmly and solidly as they could. If they couldn't get it without overstimulating their nervous systems, they considered it to be too much weight. You see, intensity is simply the level of physical and mental exertion you give to your workout. It's how intent you are on pushing yourself outside of your comfort zone and making progress. It's your desire to not just make it through your set, but to accomplish something with it. A high-intensity workout is one where you feel like you didn't leave anything in the tank. You didn't settle for a lighter weight when you felt you could have gone up. Your mind wasn't wandering elsewhere while you were lifting. You weren't just robotically going through the motions. You were consciously but calmly pounding out every rep and every set with determination. By focus, I mean mental concentration, having your mind on your lifts and not on the TV show you watched last night, the party later that night, the argument with your girlfriend, or whatever else. While there's nothing wrong with talking while resting, don't get carried away in conversation because it'll inevitably be distracting. Your rest times will drag on too long. You'll have your mind on other things when you sit down to do your set. It's just counterproductive. Save the fraternizing for after the gym. I don't want to get too woo-woo on you and say you need to hypnotically visualize every lift before you perform it, but there's definitely something to be said for having 100% of your attention on moving the weight in front of you. It's mind over matter, as they say. The bigger, leaner, stronger training routines are built to help you maintain a high level of intensity and focus. It's much easier to do 4 to 6 reps at maximum intensity and focus than 10 to 12. It's much easier to remain revved up and determined for 45 minutes than 90. But the routine itself doesn't supply the intensity and focus. You have to. Does anything change when cutting? One of many terrible pieces of training advice I hear among the bros is to train with light weights and high reps when cutting to bring out the cuts. This is 100% wrong. Focusing exclusively on high rep training doesn't help burn more fat than heavier weights. It doesn't shred you up, nor does it make you vascular. Ironically, training heavy is especially important when you're cutting because the name of the game is muscle preservation, and you need to keep overloading the muscles to accomplish this. So train hard when you're cutting and keep trying to go up in strength. Most guys experience an initial drop in strength when they switch from a bulk to a cut, but I've always managed to build my strength back up and end more or less where I began with little to no muscle loss. If I do lose any muscle when I cut, I can't see it in the mirror. How to use cardio to build muscle. Many guys fear cardio as if every minute spent performing it means a muscle and strength loss. Some bodybuilder types bash it simply because they don't like doing it. While it's clearly evident that excessive cardio causes muscle loss, just look at any marathon runner, moderate amounts of regular cardio can help you build more muscle over time. Let's look at how this works. Cardio and muscle recovery. As you know, intense exercise causes damage to muscle fibers, which must then be repaired. This damage is the likely primary cause of the soreness that you feel the day or two following a workout, known as delayed onset muscle soreness, or DOMS. Repairing the damage is a complex process that is partly regulated by two simple factors: the quantity of raw materials needed for repair that are brought to the damaged muscle over time, and the speed at which waste products are removed. Well, cardio can help your body repair muscle damage more quickly because it increases blood flow to various areas of the body. This type of active recovery delivers more raw materials to the muscles for use and removes the waste products, which results in an all-around quicker recovery period. It's worth noting, however, that these benefits are primarily seen in the legs because most forms of cardio don't involve the upper body. If you want to boost whole body recovery, then you would need to do something that gets your upper body working, like a rowing machine or using your arms to pump on the elliptical machine. Cardio and your metabolism. In our collective dietary fantasy, all nutrients eaten would be sucked into the muscles and either absorbed or burned off, and none would result in fat storage. And when we restricted our calories for fat loss, all of our energy needs would be met by burning only fat, not muscle. The reality, however, is that our bodies do these things to varying degrees. Some people's bodies store less fat when they overeat than others, and some can get away with larger calorie deficits without losing muscle. Genetics and anabolic hormone levels are the major players here, which means there just isn't much we can do about how our bodies innately respond to calorie surpluses or deficits. All is not lost if you're not a part of the genetic elite, however, because an important factor in what your body does with the food you eat is insulin sensitivity, and this is something we can positively affect. As discussed earlier in the book, retaining insulin sensitivity is highly beneficial when you're eating a surplus of calories to build muscle, whereas insulin resistance inhibits muscle growth and promotes fat storage. This is where cardio comes in, because it improves insulin sensitivity and does so in a dose-dependent manner, meaning the more you do, the more benefits you get. In this way, doing cardio can help your muscles better absorb the nutrients you eat, which can mean more muscle growth and less fat storage over time. Cardio and conditioning. A common issue in the bodybuilding world is the dramatic reduction in cardiovascular fitness when focusing only on bulking and heavy weightlifting for months on end. Building one's cardio conditioning back up is not only uncomfortable, but going from doing absolutely no cardio to doing several sessions per week in addition to putting yourself in a calorie deficit places a lot of stress on the body. This added stress makes weight loss physically and psychologically tougher, and it can even accelerate muscle loss. By keeping regular cardio in year-round, however, you can maintain your metabolic conditioning and prevent the systemic shell shock that many people experience during the beginning of a cut. It's also common for people who have bulked for months without cardio to experience an initial lag in weight loss. I've yet to find a satisfactory explanation for why this occurs, but it could be related to the fact that exercise improves the body's ability to metabolize fat, and thus regular cardio may optimize and preserve this mechanism. The bottom line is that moderate amounts of cardio most definitely don't impair muscle growth and may even accelerate it, and cardio confers other health benefits as well. I recommend that you make cardio a regular part of your routine, whether you're cutting, bulking, or maintaining. The muscle-related benefits of cardio are especially true if the exercise closely imitates the motions used in exercises performed to build muscle, like cycling or rowing. These benefits were demonstrated in a particularly interesting study conducted by researchers at Stephen F. Austin State University. What they found is that the type of cardio done had a profound effect on the subjects' ability to gain strength and size in their weightlifting. The subjects who did running and walking for their cardio gained significantly less strength and size than those who cycled. A similar effect was also seen in a study conducted by researchers at the University of Wisconsin. They separated 30 untrained men into two groups and had one follow a weight training program 3 days per week and the other do the same plus 50 minutes of cycling. After 10 weeks, they found that the men who cycled in addition to training with weights gained more thigh muscle than the weights-only group. Personally, I've been recumbent cycling 2 to 4 times per week for more than a year now, and I've enjoyed tremendous improvements in my cardiovascular endurance and resting heart rate. While I can't conclusively say that I've built more leg muscle from it, I did notice an initial increase in leg strength as they had to adapt to the new stimulus. The best type of cardio for losing fat, not muscle. Cardio machines often show pretty graphs indicating where your heart rate should be for fat burning versus cardiovascular training. You calculate this magical heart rate by subtracting your age from 200 and multiplying this number by 0.6. If you keep your heart rate at this number, you're often told you'll be in the fat burning zone. Well, there's only a slight kernel of truth here. You do burn both fat and carbohydrates when you exercise, and the proportion varies with the intensity of exercise. A very low-intensity activity, like walking, taps mainly into fat stores, whereas high-intensity sprints pull much more heavily from carbohydrate stores. At about 60% of maximum exertion, your body gets about half of its energy from carbohydrate stores and half from fat stores, which is why many experts claim that you should work in the range of 60 to 70% of maximum exertion. Based on this, you might think that I'm arguing for steady-state cardio, cardio that involves steadily keeping your effort and heartbeat in a certain range, but there's more to consider. The first issue is total calories burned while exercising. If you walk off 100 calories, 85 of which come from fat stores, that isn't as effective as spending that time in a moderate run that burns off 200 calories with 100 coming from fat. And that, in turn, isn't as effective as spending that time doing sprint intervals that burn off 500 calories with 150 coming from fat. Sprinting's benefits extend beyond the calories burned while exercising, though. A study conducted by scientists at the University of Western Ontario gives us insight into just how much more effective high-intensity cardio is. Researchers had 10 men and 10 women train 3 times per week, with one group doing between 4 and 6 30-second treadmill sprints, with 4 minutes of rest in between each, and the other group doing 30 to 60 minutes of steady-state cardio, running on the treadmill at the magical fat loss zone of 65% VO2 max. The results? After 6 weeks of training, the subjects doing the intervals had lost significantly more body fat. Yes, 4 to 6 30-second sprints burn more fat than 60 minutes of incline treadmill walking. These findings are supported by several other studies, such as those conducted by researchers at Laval University, East Tennessee State University, Baylor College of Medicine, and the University of New South Wales, which have all shown that shorter high-intensity cardio sessions result in greater fat loss over time than longer low-intensity sessions. Although the exact mechanisms of how high-intensity cardio trumps steady-state cardio for fat loss purposes aren't fully understood yet, scientists have isolated quite a few of the factors, which include the following. increased resting metabolic rate for more than 24 hours after exercise, improved insulin sensitivity in the muscles, higher levels of fat oxidation in the muscles, significant spikes in growth hormone levels, which aid in fat loss, and catecholamine levels, chemicals your body produces to directly induce fat mobilization, and post-exercise appetite suppression. High-intensity interval training not only burns more fat in less time than steady-state cardio, but it also preserves muscular size and improves performance as well. Research has shown that the longer your cardio sessions are, the more they impair strength and hypertrophy. Thus, keeping your cardio sessions short is important when we're talking about maximizing your gains in the weight room and preserving your muscle. Only high-intensity interval training allows you to do this and burn enough fat to make it worthwhile. I like the recumbent bike for my cardio, and here's how I do it. 1. I start my workout with 2 to 3 minutes of low-intensity warm-up on the lowest resistance. 2. I then bump the resistance up several notches to give me something to pedal against, but not so much that my quads get fried in just one bout. And I pedal as fast as possible for 60 seconds. If you're new to HIIT, you may need to start with 30 to 45 second sprints. 3. I then reduce the resistance to its slowest setting and pedal at a moderate pace for the same amount of time as my high intensity interval, 60 seconds. If you're new to HIIT, you may need to extend this rest period to 1.5 to 2 times your high-intensity intervals. If you sprint for 30 seconds, you may need 45 to 60 seconds of recovery. 4. I then repeat this cycle of all-out and recovery intervals for 25 to 30 minutes. 5. I finish with a 2 to 3 minute cool-down at a low intensity. That's it. I'll bring my iPad and read or watch something and the time flies by. If you'd like to do a different form of HIIT cardio, such as rowing, sprinting, swimming, jump roping, or anything else that permits it, go for it. You can apply the same simple principles. Relatively short bursts of maximum effort that spike your heart rate, followed by low-intensity recovery periods that bring it down to normal levels. If you want to include some steady-state cardio in your routine, that's fine as well. Just know that it's not as effective for fat loss purposes, and that if you do too much of it, you can impair muscle growth. Personally, I wouldn't do more than 45 to 60 minutes of steady-state cardio in one session, and in terms of weekly frequency, we'll talk about that in a minute. The best time to do cardio. When you do your cardio in relation to your weightlifting matters. Researchers from RMIT University worked with well-trained athletes in 2009 and found that combining resistance exercise and cardio in the same session may disrupt genes for anabolism. In layman's terms, they found that combining endurance and resistance training sends mixed signals to the muscles. Cardio before the resistance training suppressed anabolic hormones such as IGF-1 and MGF, and cardio after resistance training increased muscle tissue breakdown. Several other studies, such as those conducted by researchers from the Children's National Medical Center, the Waikato Institute of Technology, and the University of Jyväskylä in Finland, came to the same conclusions. Training for both endurance and strength simultaneously impairs your gains on both fronts. Training purely for strength or purely for endurance in a workout is far superior. Cardio before weightlifting also saps your energy and makes it much harder to train heavy, which in turn inhibits your muscle growth. Therefore, I recommend that you separate your weightlifting and cardio sessions by at least a few hours if at all possible. Personally, I lift early in the morning and do my cardio after work, before dinner. If there's no way that you can split up your cardio and weightlifting, do your weight training first, as cardio first will drain energy that you'll want for your lifting. While this arrangement isn't ideal, it's not a huge problem. You can still do well on the program. If you can, I recommend having a protein shake after your weightlifting and before your cardio, as this will help mitigate the muscle breakdown. How often you should do cardio. In terms of frequency, here's how I do it. When I'm bulking, I do 2 25-minute HIIT sessions per week. When I'm cutting, I do 3 to 5 25-minute HIIT sessions per week. When I'm maintaining, I do 2 to 3 25-minute HIIT sessions per week. I never do more than 5 cardio sessions per week, as I've found my strength begins to drop off in the gym if I do. Many people are shocked to learn that I do no more than 1.5 to 2 hours of cardio per week while cutting, but am able to get to the 6-7% body fat range with ease. Well, the idea that you have to do a ton of cardio to get shredded is a complete myth. It's not only unnecessary, but unhealthy as well. You don't have to do cardio to lose fat, but if you want to get down to the 10% range or below, I can pretty much guarantee you'll have to do at least 2 to 3 sessions per week. If you'd like to stick with steady-state cardio or include it in your routine, stick with the frequency recommendations given earlier. You can mix and match modalities, HIIT versus low-intensity steady-state or LISS, but I still wouldn't do more than 5 sessions per week. The bottom line, congratulations, you've just learned the core principles of the Bigger Leaner Stronger training program. Chances are that this is a new approach to training for you, and if that's the case, you should be excited. Soon you're going to be enjoying explosive muscle growth and rapid fat loss by doing relatively short, stimulating workouts that you look forward to every day and that get the kind of results other guys can only dream about. You're never going to burn yourself out with hours and hours of grueling cardio either. In fact, if you're like me, you'll come to enjoy your cardio sessions because they'll noticeably improve your performance and overall health without eating up large chunks of your free time. Next on the agenda is the discussion of the individual weightlifting exercises you're going to be performing on the program. Carry on to find out. Chapter Summary. Weightlifting. While a small number of machines are worth using, such as the leg press machine or cable setup, the vast majority are inferior to dumbbell and barbell exercises in terms of producing bigger, stronger muscles. The average guy needs to build a strong overall foundation of strength and muscle, and there's only one way to do that naturally. You have to do a lot of heavy compound weightlifting. To achieve maximum overload and muscle stimulation, you will train 1 or 2 muscle groups per workout per day. You're going to be working in the 4 to 6 rep range for nearly all exercises. The workouts on this program will call for 9 to 12 heavy or working sets per workout. Due to the amount of weight you're using in bigger, leaner, stronger workouts, you should rest for 3 to 4 minutes in between your working sets. You should be able to finish every bigger, leaner, stronger workout in 60 to 65 minutes. Between each of its 8-week phases, the Bigger Leaner Stronger program includes a choice between what is known as a deload week and several days, or even an entire week, off the weights. I recommend that you start with deload weeks, but if you don't feel reinvigorated by the end of them and physically and mentally ready to hit the heavy weights again, then I recommend that you try no training whatsoever for at least 4 to 5 days before getting back to it. The Bigger Leaner Stronger program has a simple method of progression. Once you hit 6 reps for one set, you add weight for your next set. The standard increase is a total of 10 pounds, 5 pounds added to either side of the barbell, or a 5-pound increase in each dumbbell. So long as you keep hitting the weights hard, your muscles will grow, and as your muscles grow, you'll get more and more of a pump from heavy lifting. The rep timing I recommend is either the 2-1-2 or 2-1-1 timing. This means the first part of the rep should take about 2 seconds, which is followed by a 1-second or shorter pause, which is followed by the final portion of the rep, which should take between 1 and 2 seconds. Training heavy is especially important when you're cutting because the name of the game is muscle preservation, and you need to keep overloading the muscles to accomplish this. A high-intensity workout is one where you feel like you didn't leave anything in the tank. You didn't settle for a lighter weight when you felt you could have gone up. Your mind wasn't wandering elsewhere while you were lifting. You weren't just robotically going through the motions. You were consciously but calmly pounding out every rep and every set with determination. By focus, I mean mental concentration, having your mind on your lifts and not on the TV show you watched last night, the party later that night, the argument with your girlfriend, or whatever else. Cardio. Cardio can help your body repair muscle damage more quickly because it increases blood flow to various areas of the body. Cardio improves insulin sensitivity, and in this way can help your muscles better absorb the nutrients you eat, which can mean more muscle growth and less fat storage over time. By keeping regular cardio in year-round, you can maintain your metabolic conditioning and prevent the systemic shell shock that many people experience during the beginning of a cut. The muscle-related benefits of cardio are especially true if the exercise closely imitates the motions used in exercises performed to build muscle, like cycling or rowing. HIIT not only burns more fat in less time than steady-state cardio, but it preserves muscular size and performance better as well. If you'd like to do a different form of HIIT cardio, such as rowing, sprinting, swimming, jump roping, or anything else that permits it, go for it. If you want to include some steady-state cardio in your routine, that's fine as well. Just know that it's not as effective for fat loss purposes, and that if you do too much of it, you can impair muscle growth. I recommend that you separate your weightlifting and cardio sessions by at least a few hours, if at all possible.